Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Jean Redman. Jean's the winner of the 11th Diana Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction for her body of work. We'll also hear from debut novelist Delaney Nolan talking about Happy Bad and Vanessa Sanders talking about The Flat Woman, the books they'll be introducing at this week's Tennessee Williams Festival. It's an especially happy occasion to welcome mystery novelist Jean Redman back to The Reading Life. Jean's in town for the Tennessee Williams in New Orleans Literary Festival this week and the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival. And as part of that, she's here to receive the 11th Diana Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction, recognizing her distinguished body of work. Jean, welcome back and congratulations.
Thank you, Susan. I am so honored to get this because obviously, you know, way back in the day, when I lived in New Orleans, which I still miss, I did have the fortunate to meet Diana Pinkley and know her dedication and stuff. So getting the prize named after her is, I think, especially meaningful for me, but especially, you know, you put books out there and you hope people read them. And this says, yeah, I didn't do too bad.
Not at all. Now, we should say that you retired from your day job at Crescent Care, where you worked for a long time, and you moved to Milwaukee in those cold winters.
Yeah.
But you're still devoted to New Orleans as a setting.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, New Orleans is the city of my heart and my soul. Mm-hmm. And Milwaukee was a practical decision. You know, my wife is up here. She works at the university. She's got tenure, yada, yada, yada. Cost of living are cheaper here. And, you know, we don't need to worry about evacuation, but we do need to worry about shoveling snow. But New Orleans is a city unlike any other. I mean, I love Milwaukee. It's a fine city. Nothing against it. But it doesn't have the character and that kind of depth and the anything could happen. You could be walking down the street and you run into a voodoo ceremony where they've got live snakes and that sort of stuff. And New Orleans is like, okay, it's New Orleans. I'll just move to the other side of the sidewalk and keep on walking because that's what New Orleans is. And there are a few other cities, no other cities that I know of that will give you that.
Now, does it make a difference writing about it from away? Do you feel like you see it more clearly or do you have to research it now?
Yeah, sometimes I do. I mean, sometimes, you know, I will, you know, check Google Maps and that sort of stuff and look at things. And I miss the dailiness of it because, you know, living there, you sort of get the rhythms of it. You talk to the people all the time. You see the people on the street because, you know, New Orleans, we walk down the street and we just talk to each other. And I really do kind of miss that. And I feel like, do I really have the city as it is now? Do I really catch that sort of stuff? And I have to tell myself, A, I come back on a regular basis. And B, I did live there for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up in the over on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. My father was a New Orleans native. So we lived in the area. So there's a way that growing up that I know how the light is going to look in that part of the world. And there's a way that, you know, living here now and seeing how different it is, I go, okay, there are things that are just, they're always going to be part of me. And I hope that I can continue to make it work in the writing.
So tell us about Mickey Knight, the enduring character in your longest running series. What sort of feedback do you get about her and how do you feel about her?
Well, she's not like me. I mean, you know, that she's definitely much an alter ego because, you know, even if I were, you know, a private detective, I probably would not do the kind of thing she does. But, you know, that's what books are about. They take us into worlds that we wouldn't necessarily go. She's certainly more of a smartass than I am. You know, as a writer, I get the benefit of, you know, having 3 or 4 days to come up with some of those lines and stuff. She's still an interesting character. I mean, I still kind of like her. Some of the early books were criticized saying that, you know, she's a bit of an ass. That was kind of my intent because if you have a character that has places to go, things to learn in their life, they bring conflict because they don't see things as clearly as they should, then I think it made her a more interesting character to write.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Nell McGraw, who's the protagonist of your other series.
Yeah, and I based Nell McGraw very loosely on someone my mother might have been. My mother was a newspaper person. That's actually how she and my father met. They were working on a newspaper, and she in Chicago. It's a very, very loosely on her and what she might have been in a completely different life, and, you know, years later from when she was born. But someone who is gritty and someone who grew up, you know, is working in a town that's fictional, but it was based on the town that I grew up in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. As you know, that it was published by Midnight Inc., which was one of the mid-sized mystery books publishers. And then they decided that they just didn't want to publish anymore. So it wasn't my fault. So unfortunately, yeah. So there are two books in that series. I have most of the third one written, but it's still just sitting on my computer. And I keep thinking someday, well, maybe I should figure out something to do with those books. I don't know, maybe self-published or something else with them. But unfortunately, Nell is sort of kind of in limbo.
She'll be back. I have faith.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I kind of liked her.
I do too.
It allowed me to write about things I couldn't really write about with mm-hmm. Nikki. You know, the first book was about what happens in a small Mississippi town when you discover the skeletons of people who were probably killed around the early 60s, the time of the civil rights violence.
Yeah, Mississippi's a whole other animal for us, yeah. Setting, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you've also worked on several landmark anthologies, and that kind of editing work, it's really time-consuming, but it's so important because it's like service work for the profession. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like, you know, I edited several anthologies with my good friend Greg Heron. And yes, it did get some things out. We did have one that was shortlisted for Shirley Jackson Award, so that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And as a shortlist, they gave you a little stone that just had, you know, Shirley Jackson, which is, you know, kind of cool and a little creepy when you think about it.
That's great.
Yeah. But yeah, it also connects us to community. Mm-hmm. You know, the writers we were able to showcase and what we were able to do with that. So I think that's important work. Anthologies is getting the voices out there.
And right now you're serving on the board of the Mystery Writers of America as well, too.
Yes, I am. You know, I came up to the Midwest thinking, okay, I'm not really a Midwesterner, but I got involved here and I ended up on the Midwest chapter. And somehow I started, and I'm now the president of the Midwest chapter of MWA. And I'm still sort of thinking, how did that happen? You know, but anyway, I am, which is, again, it's about, you know, it's not like I'm making these huge inroads to my career, but it's community. Again, it's how do I connect to writers now that I'm up in this place? And how do I, at least in some way, try and bring the next generation of writers? How do we keep making sure that writers get to write and the voices get heard?
Well, I love that we could call you Madam President of the Midwest Chapter.
Yeah, president is something. I'd be nice if I had a little more power to change some things, but at last I don't.
Well, I wish you did. There's some great programming that goes along with the Pinkley Prizes at the festival. The other winner with you is Kristen L. Berry for her debut novel, We Don't Talk mm-hmm. About Carol, which is also a wonderful book.
Yeah.
And Saturday afternoon, there will be three events sponsored by the Pinkley Prizes. From 1 to 2:30, there will be a panel, The Importance of Female Voices in Crime Fiction, moderated by Ramarian Corrigan of Fresh Air, with panelists Kristen L. Berry, Margot Dwahi, Cheryl Head, and you, Jean Redman, at the Hotel Monteleone Riverview Room. And then from 2:30 to 3:45, Margot Dwahi presents a passionate plotting workshop, Crucial Plot Moves That Keep Readers Hooked. And from 4 to 5:15, there will be presentation of the Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction, also at the Hotel Monteleone Riverview Room. Please RSVP to pinkleyprizes@gmail.com to secure your spot so we'll have enough champagne.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. Well, thank you so much, Jean, and congratulations. This couldn't be more deserved.
Well, thank you, Susan. I really am honored.
First up is first novelist Delaney Nolan. Her new book is Happy Bad. Delaney, tell us what your day job is.
Hi, Susan. I'm a journalist here in New Orleans. I work for The Lens, which is wonderful because I get to talk to a lot of smart people here in the New Orleans area.
And how does that kind of writing reinforce or strengthen your fiction?
Yeah, I mean, in a really straightforward way, some of the material I end up reporting on appears in the book in some form or another. Without giving too much away, some of the ending was inspired or informed by some reporting I did years ago for Al Jazeera about Ile de Jean Charles and the Biloxi Chitimacha tribe recovering from Hurricane Ida. And then in another way, it's just fun to have sort of two buckets to put stuff in, one that's true and one that's imagined.
And don't you find that when one project kind of slows down, you can turn to the other for inspiration sometimes?
Yeah, it's great to have a new way to procrastinate. You know, if you want to put off one, you always get to work on the other. So that's also a really nice bonus.
So give us the setup for this book. Tell us a little bit about its initial inspiration in your life.
Yeah, I mean, I came from a pretty specific place, I guess I would say, which was when I was getting my MFA in Iowa. I volunteered sometimes at a residential treatment center for teenage girls. And then a couple of years later, I was doing a Fulbright in Greece at the height of the Syrian refugee crisis, working with Syrian refugees. And I was really struck by some of the parallels that I would see there, just in terms of sort of imbalanced power dynamics and the way people were vulnerable, and also the way people who worked there were, you know, experiencing secondhand trauma and really severe burnout. And that was kind of the first, I would say the very first spark for this book, was kind of exploring this really rich, intense, and strange dynamic when people are working in these very, like, fraught situations, and emotions run really high, and that's where it began, I would say.
Well, read us a little bit so we'll have a sense of what it's like.
I would love to. All right, this is from chapter one of Happy Bad. I lived in a box in the desert. I slept in stiff white sheets. All night, my dreams swam with the things the girls drew on class assignments and birthday cards. Lilies and blades and lopsided skulls. Impossible planets lit like lamps from within. They didn't know how things worked. I had to tell them, stop drawing. Pay attention. Listen. Every 2 weeks, I received a paycheck, which I spent on bleach and wine. And then, at home, delighted, I changed my sheets, I wiped the window, I touched the floor, thrilled to be someplace clean. The things that happened at work, the vomit, the mania, the tampons thrown at heads, all that I kept in a hazard orange bucket in my heart, which was sealed the moment I walked out the doors of Twin Bridge. Home was safe. Work was work. I had a system. I had a system and a scheme in Texas, a system of complicated, invisible mental pulleys which functioned so that I could successfully oversee the girls who started every morning sleepy in the cafeteria, learning to dance. Usually, at Twin Bridge, I was on the morning shift. Mornings, the girls spent lined up in the calf, shaking their feel-good hips, flipping their hair, askew in the hideously boring earth, pinwheeled behind them. Above, cold light, drop tile ceiling. Below, white linoleum tile that had weathered very many feet and bodily fluids. The oldest girl, Teresa, stood in front of the line, her back to me, instructing the others. Her manner was military. Pay attention, she commanded. She took a big step backward, shifted her weight, and fell to the floor like she'd been shot, her limbs in a pile. Then she rose up slowly, turning to the side and bent at the waist, gyrating. That's what, she said.
Oh, I love that. I can see it.
Thank you.
Now, you also invented a drug trial for these girls to undergo.
Oh, yes.
So tell us about B-Zen.
B-Zen is
a great invention. I mean,
who wouldn't want some? It
yeah.
feels like if we got really good at making Valium. So Happy Bad is set maybe 15, 20 years in the future. We're not quite at dystopian future level yet. We're just, you know, a little farther down along this path that we're going, whatever that means to you. And one of the things I'm interested in looking at in the book is sort of the pathologization of mental health or struggles, especially in young people, and how often, you know, we see people offered medication instead of some of the other things you might need to feel like a stable person, like safe housing or breakfast every morning or a supportive peer group. So that's why there's pills on the cover. The way that that sort of ends up coming up and affecting is when they're evacuating, the B-Zen begins to run out. and then we see what happens.
And everybody here can identify with evacuation. But talk a little bit about the tipping point of climate change we find ourselves at in this book.
It's interesting you use the word tipping point, because one of the things that I thought about a lot working on this book is, I guess the technical term for it is changing baseline syndrome. And that means that as things do change from our climate warming and weather getting more extreme and all the things that come with that, what we're used to as normal also shifts very slowly. And I was especially interested in how, you know, the next generation, people who were born now, are going to be used to a different normal. And they don't notice things changing quite the way that we might after being alive and paid attention for 60 years. And so I kind of wanted to push back almost against the idea of there being a tipping point, like a certain moment when we finally all realize, okay, it's real, it's really bad, it's really happening. Because I think it happens actually in this very slowly way, a very slow way. And we here in New Orleans, we get more of a front seat to it than other places do. So we're more aware, I think.
So are you deep into your next book already?
Yeah, I'm working on another book that would be a little more of a different countries following a few generations of a family kind of book, but still getting drafted.
All right. Can't wait. We've been talking with Delaney Nolan, whose debut novel is Happy Bad. You can see her at the Tennessee Williams Festival this weekend. Delaney, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Another one of the writers who'll be introducing her novel at the Tennessee Williams Festival is Vanessa Saunders. Her experimental novel is called The Flat Woman. Now, Vanessa, tell us what your day job is.
So I work as a professor of practice at Loyola University, New Orleans. So, you know, I teach courses on literature and creative writing. And for a while, I was also leading the English reading series, which was a lot of fun as well.
Oh, that's great. Now, how do you meld the two kinds of writing lives that you have?
You know, it can be tough sometimes, especially at certain times of year, just because right now my teaching load is pretty high. But I found that, you know, the work is not, they aren't two kind of like separate practices. It's really like it's one practice. And I have found that like oftentimes, or I'm working through ideas kind of in my conversations and discussions with students. I am often leading, you know, discussion seminars. And so kind of like this back and forth, I think that I'm often like leading discussions about the topics that I'm interested in as a writer. And I think as well, when you're teaching creative writing, you have to come to class with a very like specific view of the craft elements that each student is kind of using in their work. And so that has really helped me, you know, become a better writer myself, is sometimes you're giving someone else advice that you actually realize that you should be giving to yourself. Right. That happens, I think, more than you think.
And don't you find that if you have two different writing projects going on at once, that when one stops for a while, you can turn to the other and come back revitalized?
For sure. Yeah. I think that, you know, I do work with people, but I've also found that if I don't look at something for a very long period of time, I will completely detach from it and read it like I never wrote it. Mm-hmm. And that is just like, I think, the point at which a project really becomes the best version of itself, is when you can just get away from it for a while and read it like a stranger wrote it, and then think about, okay, well, what advice would I give the stranger? And that's the advice you're taking about yourself.
Now, The Flat Woman has already gotten some exciting recognition. So tell us a little bit about it and what the first spark for this book was.
Yeah, so I think that one thing that someone told me, an agent who contacted me early on, was that she's like, your book is good and your book is going to have legs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here we're 16 months after publication and, you know, I'm still kind of like, I have high school students reach out to me. I have, you know, librarians reach out to me. So it's been really, yeah, exciting, I think, to make something that people actually read. I can't tell you, you know, how satisfying that is. And I've got to meet a lot of amazing people, kind of like going to conferences and being a featured writer at literary festivals. I've got to meet so many kind of fascinating local writers like Anel Lopez and Maggie Sheffer, who have been so kind of like instructive to, you know, my kind of furthering my understanding of my craft just through reading their work and through talking to them. So I think of all the things that have happened, I feel kind of really grateful just for the people that I've met along the way.
Well, read a little bit for us from the very beginning.
Okay. So on the morning of her sixth birthday, the girl woke up with a rash of bird feathers. A plate of gray and white seagull feathers, thick as a coat of armor, covered her back from her neck to the base of her spine. It was painful to sit up, painful to lie down, painful to stand on her legs, the feather shafts poking out of her skin. "I'm sorry," Mama said as she left for work. "Your aunt will be here soon to watch you." By 10 a.m., the girl developed a fever so high, sweat soaked through her downy coat. Tripping, she tried to walk to the bathroom and saw floating crescent moons rise from the hallway floor. Her aunt found her in bed, wet and hot and feathered. "Come on," her aunt said. "You'll feel better if we go to the zoo." Feathers mashed in a ball under her sweater, the girl walked with her aunt, hand in hand, staring at the gulls circling the air. Her aunt bought her a hot dog with relish, then they stared at some sea lions lying on a rock. From their glass cage, the sea lions barked and wagged their tails. The girl tried to eat, but her warm tongue just pushed the food around her mouth, unhungry. Suddenly, a flock of seagulls descended on them, a blaze of white feathers, dark claws, and throaty squawks. When the gulls tore the hot dog from the girl's hand, her aunt tried to let go of the girl and shrieked. Falling to the ground, her aunt pushed the girl in front of her. The girl tripped on her shoelace and fell face first. The sound of gull wings flapping filled her ears as they followed her down, cutting her knuckle flesh, drawing blood. The girl believed she was going to die based on the red liquid seeping into the pavement, her aunt screaming, and the talons scraping the back of her neck. Eventually, the sound stopped. They raised their heads tentatively, a clear sky. Her aunt slowly stood up, bleeding from her hands. She tried to wipe the blood trickle off her arm, but only smeared the rust-colored fluid down her mangled wrist. She gathered her purse. "They were trying to get their revenge," she said, "for what we've allowed to happen." They both ran to the car, not wishing to see any more creatures.
Wow. That beginning is so powerful, I think.
Oh, I'm so glad that you liked it.
So what will you be doing at the festival this weekend?
So I am actually talking about dystopian literature with some of the NOCA students, who I'm super thrilled about because I've had students from NOCA and they're all very amazing. So I'm super excited to kind of talk with them.
Oh, that's great. Now, do you remember when it is?
It's Friday, the 27th, and it is, I believe it's at noon or 12:30 or noon.
Okay, super. We've been talking with Vanessa Sanders, who teaches at Loyola University and will be part of this weekend's Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival. Vanessa, I love The Flat Woman. I can't wait for other readers to discover it.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival winds down this weekend. Here are some picks for lively entertainment. Friday, March 27th from 4 to 5 p.m., a special event at the Hotel Monteleone Queen Anne Ballroom, Thrumming to the Work of Art, a reading. Readings by Robert Olin Butler, Michael Cunningham, Jewel Gomez, Martin Sherman and Justin Torres, hosted by Maureen Corrigan, author and book critic for NPR's Fresh Air. Saturday, March 28th, The Joy Theater, 1200 Canal, doors at 8 p.m. and show at 9 p.m., Lady Beast Productions presents Vaudeville Revival. Vaudeville Revival is an annual Lady Beast production spectacle, one night only, entirely new acts and never to be repeated. This year's show celebrates the electric lineage of circus and vaudeville, from historic legends to local heroes and international stars. Audiences can expect high-flying trapeze, iron jaw, cowboy antics, true clowning, comedy, and jaw-dropping variety. 21 and older, please. Ticket info at TennesseeWilliams.net. And who could resist Saturday at 2:30 to 3:45 p.m., the Saints and Sinners Writers' Craft, The Grass is Blue, a Dolly Parton poetry workshop. What could the songs of legendary singer-songwriter Dolly Parton teach us about writing, craft, and perspectives in poetry? In this in-person workshop, poet and co-editor of Let Me Say This, a Dolly Parton poetry anthology, Dustin Brookshire guides participants in writing new poems. That's at the Hotel Monteleone, lobby level, Royal Salon. And coming up, Lavender Inc. celebrates four new releases with a publication party Tuesday, March 31st at 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Parlo Beer Lab. The poets are Justin LaCour, author of A Reading From The Book of Panic, Jonathan Penton, author of A Limited Number of Miracles, Ann Pleek, author of New Barrier Islands, and Bill Lavender, whose most recent book is City of God, published by Mad Hat Press. Poets Liz Burke, Peter Cooley, Rodney Jones, Julie Kane, and Biljana Obradovic read at the Poetry Buffet Saturday, April 4th at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. In celebration of National Poetry Month, the New Orleans Pelicans are partnering with One Book New Orleans for Pelicans and Poetry. Local poets Stacy Balkin, Kelly Jarvis DeBerry, Sky Jackson, Sean Monroe, and Christopher Romagero will appear for a reading and happy hour before tip-off against the Utah Jazz Tuesday, April 7th. Use the special ticket link and a portion of the proceeds benefit One Book.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.